You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. I'd like to welcome Gary Paul Nabhan. He's a writer, a seed conservationist, he's endowed chair in sustainable agriculture at the University of Arizona. He is a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant recipient. He's recognized as the father of the local food movement. He's author of the book Food from the Radical Center, Healing Our Land and Communities. And he will be in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday, September 24th at 6:30 in the evening. Welcome, Gary Nabhan.
Thank you so much.
So this book is called Food from the Radical Center, and the Radical Center seems to people who don't know that term like kind of an oxymoron. What does that term mean? How did it come into being?
The term Radical Center means bringing people together in a way where we all walk toward the middle of common goals and common values. Bill McDonald, a rancher on the New Mexico-Arizona border, began to use the term in relation to the rancher-environmentalist conflict resolution that occurred after the Sagebrush Rebellion and Range Wars in the 1990s that many people in New Mexico and Arizona were involved with. And the term stuck, and a lot of productive work came out of people emphasizing their common values rather than their differences.
You describe something in the book that happened when a woman was giving a talk at the Society for Ecological Restoration, and it kind of changed the way you saw. You were really pretty much a hardcore, like, Earth Day environmentalist. Is that right?
That's right. I worked at the first Earth Day. I lived in the neighborhood in Tucson where Earth First as an organization had its headquarters. And so I was, for many years, a radical environmentalist of the same ilk of folks like Ed Abbey and Jack Loeffler and Dave Foreman, and still admire those people greatly. But I saw this remarkable event take place where a woman came into a session at an ecological restoration meeting that was an event that was really celebrating the closing of logging in the Northwest because of the spotted owl and other endangered wildlife issues. And this woman, rather than dressing like environmentalists, looked like a rancher or rancher's wife, however you want to say it. And I immediately saw this body reaction, this body language in the room that most of the men, but even some women in the room, were dismissing her as not being one of their people. And she started to talk about a group of former loggers who had begun to do stream restoration. And she could see that no one was paying attention to her because she said she was the wife of a former logger and that she was working with loggers. And there was clear dismissal from the audience. And I was watching this, and then she did something odd. She said, "I need to go to the bathroom. I know it's odd to do that in the middle of my talk, but I'll be back in 2 minutes. She came back in 2 minutes, and she was dressed like everyone else in the room rather than in a pantsuit and cowboy boots. She had on a T-shirt and Tevas and khaki pants and chums on around her neck with her glasses on it and said, "You all were dismissing me simply because of the way I look and my accent, and I don't want you to dismiss me because of the work that my husband and the former loggers that we work with is so important to the future of the wildlife that you care about that I want you to pay attention and listen. Needless to say, I was humbled and completely embarrassed and shamed by my own buy-in for a good part of my life to that kind of dynamic. But it really made me make the commitment to listen to people of all walks of life, all dialects, all accents, and all cultures and races, that I have more to learn from them than they can possibly learn from me.
Well, and that's one of the basic ideas of this book, which is that human diversity is more, just like biodiversity in ecosystems, human diversity is more adaptive for creativity and problem solving and getting along in the community than the more familiar kind of top-down decision-making, okay, this is how we're going to do it, now implement the plan. Give us a few examples of what that kind of human diversity looks like on the ground. I mean, your book is full of wonderful examples like this, of really solving problems, solving ecosystem, solving restoration problems.
Over the last two decades, I've seen a remarkable coalescence of interests in the counties in southeastern Arizona, where ranchers of Hispanic heritage and Anglo heritage, Quakers and Catholics, women and men, have come together to work on dealing with the arroyo cutting that happened a century ago and to heal the wounds in our landscape. And my best example of someone who came up through ranching with a very different background than my own. I grew up in a city and then turned to agriculture as my interest, where he grew up within it, fifth generation borderlands family. Joe Quiroga, one day when he was age 60, said, "I need to start making check dams and gabions and other water control structures in every wash or water course or arroyo on the ranch that I'm working on, and I'm going to dedicate 2 to 3 hours every day for the rest of my life to that." He's over 75 years old, and he's built over 1,200 water control structures that has brought back water flows of a quarter to over a half mile with cottonwoods and willows and many other trees now growing along places that were completely scoured out. He has a skill set and a way of looking at land restoration that the people who call their profession ecological restoration deeply need to understand, because he's watched the same piece of land over many, many years and know where the nick points for damage are and knows how to deal with them on very little capital. This isn't government subsidized work. This is something he does with a crowbar, a come along, and a pickup truck bumper. And he's probably had a greater influence on healing the landscape than any person I know, but yet because he dresses like a ranch foreman and he's of a Hispanic background, he's incredibly intelligent, well-read, very open and compassionate person, but on superficial bases, someone could dismiss him as being an anti-environmentalist. And when we finally honored him on Earth Day 4 years ago, we had Society of Range Management people, other ranchers, wildlife biologists, and it felt that our community was coming together to heal our wounds, not just that Joe Quiroga was healing the wounds in an arroyo.
Very interesting. I mean, it's so much about, well, first of all, as you said before with that example, you know, not judging a book by its cover, not judging people by the way they look or speak and by what their profession is, but really listening and building trust, forming relationships, and that takes place over time. You can't do that in a day or a week or even a year. And I was thinking, you know, we've got all these slow movements, slow food, slow money. This is like slow land management or something along those lines.
You have it right. This is something that is probably occurring all around us, but not many of us have the lens to see that this good work is happening, and it is bottom-up rather than top-down. And yet now there's good economic evidence that indicates that it's about a $9.5 billion output from these restorative activities, what's now called the restorative economy, that's directly employing people like Joe, 125,000 Americans every year, and another 95,000 getting benefits, economic benefits from this work by doing the accounting or the truck driving or the backhoe business to help support these restorative economies. And now it's the fourth largest industry in the West. And who would know that just by the way we look at the landscape in New Mexico and Arizona, that restoration itself is now the fourth largest economic activity after logging and mining and tourism.
What is the restoration economy? Who funds it? Like, who's paying in? Who's buying? Who's selling?
It's a diversified portfolio of funders, but a lot of it is really sweat equity within the communities. So where I work, we've gotten U.S. Department of Agriculture contracts and grants through the National Association of Conservation Districts, 17,000 districts around the country, from the Western Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. But these are small grants where everyone who gets a dollar of that federal money has to match it with sweat equity. So these are neighbors coming together across racial and cultural lines quite often to do work on the ground together. And simply by being down in a gully, side by side, shovel to shovel, you put aside your ideological differences and you get to know the wisdom and insights and skill sets and talents of the person next to you who you may have never talked to before, even though she or he may live within 10 miles of where you live. So it's a cultural healing that's going on through this work, not just healing the landscape.
And one of the key points here that you're talking about, and Courtney White talks about this, is that we need to think of our land as both a source of economic productivity and as a set of ecosystems full of life that need to be respected, and waterways and so on. And that's a kind of different paradigm than you've got your conservation land set aside over here and then your food and your timber producing lands on the other side. This is a model of doing both simultaneously. Now, you're talking about the economics of restoration. What are the economics of actually producing products, whether it be food or wood or whatever, in that restorative way? I mean, I think a lot of people would say, well, it's just more expensive to do it that way. I mean, look at how expensive organic food is and fair trade products and so on. But what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think, again, there's a hidden economy, and it's hidden because it's mostly an informal economy that happens at roadside stands and swap meets and farm-to-restaurant sales that are done by someone bringing a pickup truck to the back door of a small restaurant. And that's an increasingly large portion of the economy of the Western states. But, of course, it's always happened right where your listeners are living in northern New Mexico. It's how Hispanic and Native American communities have bartered and traded and cost-shared for decades and decades. And during the 2008 Depression, many of our communities were devastated. Tucson, Arizona, where I teach and do research from, just bottomed out completely. And since then, we've seen 140 different products from restored landscapes, desert grasslands, oak woodlands, pinyon juniper woodlands, crop up in our farmers markets, in our restaurants and coffee bars and microbreweries that are from the landscape right where we live. And it's oftentimes paired with restoration work where we eliminate invasive blackberries or horehound or horseradish to make room for native plants, but we're harvesting the edible products at the same time we're restoring the natives. And we have now 40 different microenterprises in the Tucson area that are creating jobs for hundreds of people, that lost their jobs after 2008. So this informal economy isn't in the kind of statistics that we see from the USDA or the Census Bureau, but it's an increasingly large portion of the economic dynamics on the Navajo Reservation in the Rio Arriba and down where I live on the border.
It's still a tiny part of the whole, though, isn't it?
Innovation always happens at the margins. And when we began what's now called the local food movement 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Coming Home to Eat that was one of the first battle cries or manifestos of that movement. People said the same thing. Well, this isn't going to amount to anything. But since then, we found a five-fold increase in farmers markets, and literally a third of all American farmers are putting some of their products into local food venues like restaurants and farmers markets and swap meets rather than just putting them into the globalized economy. It's no longer marginal, and it's the same thing is true about the social, not just the economic benefits of this kind of community-based restoration of food-producing landscapes. It's not only changing our economies because it's creating more livelihoods, but it's also changing the dynamics between us. We just don't see the kind of acrimony between ranchers and environmentalists in many places that we saw 25 years ago. They're collaborating. People are saying, oh, if you're going to go grass-fed beef or wolf-friendly beef, I will buy your products. And ranchers, I'm not saying all ranchers, but a good portion of them now understand that if they're taking care of the land and taking care of their livestock in a way that heals wounds on the land and creates good food, that people are with them, will buy their product and stand up for them in public hearings because they care about that. So one of the greatest divides this work is helping to heal is that urban-rural divide.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting piece because that is so much of what our political red-blue divide is about. Do you see that being, I mean, sometimes when I talk to people about politics and the sort of truism is our country is so divided, and I think about the radical center work in agriculture, do you see that as having potential to have a broader effect on our kind of nation's conversation?
I do, but I have to say that if I'm getting to know a conservative Republican rancher, and those two adjectives don't always go with the noun rancher, because ranchers are an incredibly diverse and bright and well-connected community. But if I start out with the politics of it, saying, you know, I know you probably voted for Trump, and I probably voted for so-and-so, and we're not really on the opposite sides of the political spectrum. We're all interested in the same work. I think it's a wrong first step. What I'm saying is I really need to get to know someone before I talk politics. And when I do, I find out that 70-year-old ranchers have voted the way they have because they're grief-stricken because so many jobs have left their area and their grandchildren have to go to Las Vegas or Phoenix to work because there's no rural jobs. And they attribute that to the top-down regulation and the many constraints that they have placed on them by environmental agencies and organizations. And to walk back out into a broader conversation really means to me that I first not only have to listen to them, but empathize with the deep grief that they feel of how the world has changed away from what they knew 20, 25 years ago, and the hopes that their own children and grandchildren could work and live in the same community.
Very interesting. Let's talk for a moment about soil, which really is at the root of all this, no pun intended. But there was an article that's been circulating around the internet for the last few years that basically says if we continue to use industrial farming practices, the world's topsoil will be pretty much gone in 60 years. And the same article, it's a short article, also says that generating 3 centimeters of topsoil takes 1,000 years. 1,000 years, is that true? What's your experience of generating, regenerating topsoil?
Well, that's a great question, and I want to say that I am concerned, as you are, about that enormous soil loss that is part and parcel of some kinds of annual crop agriculture. It's not endemic to all kinds of production of annual crops, but it is where I grew up in the Midwest, where farmers are out on their tractors plowing and disking Roundup Ready weeds that are resistant to herbicides more than they may be on the ground looking at their crops. So the soil loss over the last 100 years has been incredible. But when people started sounding the warning cry of the long-term consequences of soil loss 20 years ago, a lot of things were really quickly mobilized by these soil conservation districts. And the trends now show that we're losing far less soil per se than we lost per acre 20 years ago. And that's still not enough. But we're now turning our attention to the fact that when we lost that soil, we also lost the soil microbes and the life in the soil. And so now composting and mulching and applying liquid microbial mixes to increase the soil diversity is creating new jobs and, in fact, new businesses in our area. And some of my former students founded something at the University of Arizona called Compost Cats that started just picking up all the food waste on campus and composting at the university farm. Now it's collaborating with the San Javier Tohono-O'odham tribe in a major composting operation with the city of Tucson to collect food waste from all the restaurants that are willing to participate in the program. And that soil's going back onto the land with rich microbial mixtures in it. So I'm positive that we have people who are innovators who have shown that you can return life to depleted soils in a matter of 6 to 10 years. And I've seen this in the Phoenix area, where a brilliant EPA scientist retired to farm applied as much as 1.5 feet of compost over a desertified landscape, and now he has 35-foot trees in a desert oasis of 10 acres right on the edge of Metro Phoenix. That is just a remarkable achievement in a short period of time, and it's actually changing the soil below the compost, the hard pan that was there, that was left after the topsoil had been stripped, and changing it chemically for the better. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing story. I mean, here you read 1,000 years and people just sort of take that to be the truth, and you're talking about a decade or less. And I was thinking about land restoration as sort of analogous to going to the doctor. Like, if you're sick, you might get well on your own, but there's a greater chance that if you're really sick, you better go get your bones set or get the medicine you need or whatever. And land restoration can really speed up healing in such a profound way.
That's right. And the two are not unrelated. The human health and the soil health, of course, have been shown to be more intimately tied together than we could have ever imagined.
You talked about how innovation comes from the margins and sort of works its way to be eventually what they called a disruptive industry. Like, a few people had cell phones and next thing you know, the landline business is almost out of business. But you still, like right now, we still have this situation where corporate America is producing industrial food. I'm reading this book right now on glyphosate, which is also called Roundup, and that's a harrowing story of power and greed and this poison. And the stories you're telling, which are about people working kind of at the edges of this system, are very inspiring and very optimistic stories. What about people in big ag, in industrial agriculture? Do you see any signs that those folks are moving toward healthier practices?
I do, and I have to say that I see as much heterogeneity in the people and their values in big agriculture as I see in any other realm, in organic agriculture, all that. So I don't want to paint pictures of these monolithic, unilateral, us versus them kinds of things, big ag versus small ag. But when the monarch butterfly populations of North America hit less than 5% of their former numbers, I had already been working on pollinator conservation and restoration for 20 years. And basically, I stopped everything for 2 years to just work on the solutions that could bring habitat back that had been destroyed by agrochemicals before we lost the great migrations of monarch butterflies altogether. And I was in dozens of sessions where the seed industry, the chemical industry, the farm equipment industry, we're all there with government agencies, with radical nonprofits, and we had to learn to talk to one another. It was a time of great stress on me because I do not believe that walking toward the radical center, walking into the middle, means giving up your values or giving in on what you believe is essential to human health and human rights, or to land health. But through those discussions, we saw millions of dollars begin to flow into monarch butterfly conservation from industry that had never paid attention to the positive benefits that invertebrate animals offer to us. And they began to be sensitized of how important honeybees and monarch butterflies and nectar-feeding bats are. And now there's a remarkable thing that's happened, that they have trained more than 70,000 farmers in collaboration with federal agencies and nonprofit groups like the Xerces Society and the National Pollinator Partnership. 70,000 farmers have been trained just within the last 4 years on how to do least harm to monarch butterflies and to bees so that their farmlands can support healthier populations of pollinators. Now, they said to us, don't start with asking every farmer to give up Roundup next year. That chemical may transition out and others may come on, but start with how we can create habitat and start with the positive values that monarchs and bees play in the landscape, and we'll have something to talk about. If you start saying either change or there's going to be a lawsuit, we're not going to be at the table with you. It was grueling, difficult work, but I learned so much by being at the table with people that I just thought up until that time were my adversaries. I saw that there were risks of giving in to basic tenets, like it's no good to plant 5 acres of milkweeds for bees and monarch butterflies if people are still spraying that same landscape. But I began to see the conversation move because we stayed in it with one another rather than disparaging one another. And that's not something that most environmentalists are willing to do yet. And that's the standoff between the ag industry and environmentalists that we do in so many places in this country. And that's going to take years to overcome and change. But there's young scientists in those industries who want to do ecological agriculture that's less damaged. And I think we're going to be moving toward that at an increasingly rapid pace.
Very interesting. There's also an interesting story in your book. It's kind of another pollinator story about bats. There's a certain species of bat that drink the nectar from the agave plant, which makes mezcal and tequila. And they engineered or hybridized a new kind of agave plant that didn't give those flowers for the bats. And so it was a long process again of working with these manufacturers to restore flowering agave. What happened? Did it end up successful?
Well, it's a remarkable story. A good friend of mine for the last 20 years, Rodrigo Medellin, who's probably one of the greatest wildlife ecologists Mexico has ever offered to the world, is now known as the Batman of America. Mm-hmm. And he stayed with this idea that we had and made it his own to certify growers of agaves who offered a diversity of plants in their fields that reduced herbicide and pesticide use that could affect bats and other pollinators, and that could really encourage the growers of agave for tequila or mezcal to plant 300-some plants per hectare that would flower so that bats could get no nectar from those flowers. We tried that idea 20 years ago, but we didn't have the entry point into the tequila industry. Rodrigo partnered with a remarkable man, a true innovator, David Suro, who grew up in the tequila zone near Guadalajara, Mexico, and became one of the greatest importers of Mexican foodstuffs and tequila on the East Coast. And when he heard Rodrigo talk about this issue with agaves and read a book that Ana Valenzuela and I wrote about it, he decided to set up a foundation that funds what's now called the Tequila Interchange. And I'm working with him in Sonora, Mexico, to recruit and certify growers there of mezcal. And he has 8 to 12 significant producers of tequila and mezcal already on board in Jalisco and Oaxaca. So again, it couldn't have worked unless we had that private-public partnership, the business know-how from inside the economic community that makes their living off these plants, working with the biologists that wanted to save the tequila plants and the bats. So again, when we walk across the aisle and develop confidence with partners that we used to dismiss as being unuseful or irrelevant to our work, I think we have more to gain than we have to lose.
What about the investment community? We've been talking about producers, but what about the community that does investing? Do you see a willingness to invest in regenerative agriculture from people who have a profit motive?
I have seen that, and right in your own backyard, the first meeting of the Slow Money Network happened about 12 to 15 years ago. Woody Tash, the founder of Slow Money, started his organization in the Santa Fe area. And the number of people that are now investing their wealth, as we've seen this intergenerational turnover of family properties and stocks and legacies, is going more and more to playing a positive role in this kind of restorative economy, not just restoring agriculture, but rangelands, trout streams, a whole variety of economic activities that produce food for people and conserve wildlife through investments first in the flagship species like salmon or bison. So in Alaska, there's an effort to bring fishermen together with ocean conservationists and forest conservationists to make sure that the whole salmon economy up on the Alaskan shores is sustainable. Friends of mine in the Intertribal Bison Council in your own area and down in South Texas are collaborating cross-culturally to provide better genetics to a wider batch of breeding bulls for grass-fed beef production in arid lands. So it's taking unique collaborations to get a toehold to start the momentum to move these to the next scale. But it's already past the litmus test stage. And these people involved in these efforts are not only making money, but they're doing it in a way that regenerates rather than depletes the resource upon which their livelihood is based.
So as we've talked about, a lot of this work at the Radical Center is about building bridges across the urban-rural divide. How do you see the role of urban people who are not urban farmers or gardeners? They're not directly involved in any way. They're probably not going to be. They're going about their normal lives. They're trying to survive. Maybe they work in areas that really have nothing to do with the outdoors. So they become more aware. But what then? Is there a powerful role for making good food choices at the store? Are there other roles that urban people can play?
There are many ways that urban dwellers who aren't involved in food production personally are now providing not just financial support, but policy support for farmers and ranchers themselves. One group called Farm Folk, City Folk in British Columbia offers reciprocal visits of farmers to urban food co-ops and the food co-ops going out to the farms. And what you see is people in dialogue with one another who don't have that opportunity during the daytime when they're working. When I was young, I took inner city black kids from Gary, Indiana, out to Amish and Mennonite farms near Goshen, Indiana, a great area where sustainable agriculture with draft animals had been practiced for over a century. And both groups of people were changed by that interaction. Much more respect for what farmers do by the urban children and their teachers, and vice versa. A delight and a pleasure in seeing the bright young minds of urban black and Hispanic kids by these Amish and Mennonite farmers in their overalls and straw hats. And our divides are so deep in this country right now. Any day you listen to the news, you feel that we're the worst shape that we've been in since the Civil War. And we need these healing gestures now more than ever before in the history of America.
Gary Paul Nabhan is author of the book Food from the Radical Center, Healing Our Land and Communities. And once again, he will be in Santa Fe on Monday, September 24th at 6:30 at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, look forward to being in your community. I just love what you do with the show. You're kind of like a beacon to all of us in the Southwest, and you've had so many of my dear friends on your show whose work inspires me, Courtney White, Jack Leffler. They're all my heroes, so you're in the nursery grounds of innovation there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community, and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.